Go for it.
Welcome to Current Affairs. My name is Nathan Robinson. I am the editor-in-chief of Current Affairs magazine, and I am joined tonight by Dean Preston, a member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, where he represents District 5. Dean Preston is also a member of the Democratic Socialists of America and was, in fact, the first Democratic Socialist elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors in over 40 years. And he is, I believe this has been quantitatively measured, the furthest left member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Am I right that there's a chart showing this?
There is a chart, and I think when it was published, they thought it was going to be viewed as an insult, and I was thrilled to see documentation of my left position
by a pretty wide margin. But you know, people who are not familiar with San Francisco might think, you'd have to be really far left to be on the left in San Francisco. But as we'll discuss, not necessarily the case. Just to give a little bit more of your background before you joined the Board of Supervisors, you had a long career as a tenants' rights activist and attorney, and were part of the leading the initiative to stop the state of California from getting rid of rent control, and have basically made housing your central issue for most of your life, which is why it's kind of interesting and ironic some of the press that has been coming out recently, which we're going to discuss. But I want to begin with the housing situation in San Francisco. My picture as a non-San Franciscan who has not set foot in the city for many years is of a place where the rent is too damn high, that is a gentrifying city, a city where homelessness is out of control, and the class divide of the United States can be really seen in its most brutal form. Is that a caricatured picture of San Francisco and its housing situation at the moment? How accurate is that?
It's pretty accurate. And first off, Nathan, thanks for having me on, and appreciate the intro. We have extreme inequity in San Francisco, and obviously the tech industry has led a big boom in the local economy. The real estate industry has done everything it can to keep fueling the real estate speculation here, and so prices have gone up and away. We have some state laws in California that have stopped us from adopting stronger protections for tenants and stronger protections against runaway rents. Those are the laws I've been battling against for the last 20 years at the state level. But look, we've got housing that is completely unaffordable to low-income people or working-class people in the city of San Francisco. Any new units that come online at market levels are only affordable to wealthy folks or to real estate investors. We just had a report on the committee that I'm the vice chair of, the Land Use Committee. We just had a report on Monday from a broad coalition of affordable housing advocates, almost the entire labor community, and UC Berkeley professors worked for 2 years looking at our housing situation. What they found was 7% of workers in the city and county of San Francisco can actually afford housing here, the median cost of housing here. So it is not a caricature, but we have extreme inequity, high homelessness numbers, and a lot of people who aren't reflected in those numbers who simply leave. You know, if they're displaced from their home, from their rent control home, no way they're going to afford another place in San Francisco.
What are the biggest obstacles to changing this? The New York Times just had this report on the hypocrisy of blue states, which I liked in part because it was about the fact that when you look at some of the bluest cities in America, the most heavily Democratic, they are places where wealth inequality is just out of control, and they pose the question, which I think is a very serious question, which is why do places where all of the, or a large majority of the people would describe themselves as liberal-minded people who believe in affordable housing, don't like having a homelessness crisis. Why is it that these places can't solve these problems? What would you attribute that to in San Francisco in particular?
An over-reliance on a market that thrives on inequality. And so, you know, the certainly what has earned me the ire of the, you know, the local Chronicle and this so-called YIMBY movement and so
which
forth.
Which we will discuss.
Yeah, is they are market fundamentalists. And they believe that that simply creating more housing for rich people will ultimately trickle down to people who aren't rich. I don't know at what point, maybe a decade, maybe 50 years. I don't know when they expect that to happen. But that is, for all the talk in a city, even a city that's more progressive on some issues, for all the talk, when it comes down to who our economy caters to, not just in housing, but especially in housing, it caters to the wealthy. It is a struggle to do real progressive taxation. We have growing wealth inequality, and we still have even folks who describe themselves as left, liberal, progressive, whatever label you want to put on it. They're still primarily voting to give more power to the very market that has created the inequality in the first place. So, I was more of a believer in these markets earlier in my career. I mean, I thought well-regulated capitalism, maybe we could get there. I thought, we just control the rents a bit and have some protections in place. Maybe this can work if we just, make developers do a handful of affordable units when they build, maybe we'll get there somehow, And, decades later, it doesn't work. And until we actually admit that and look at non-market solutions like social housing and things that can actually reverse these trends, until we do that, we're just going to get more of the same.
Yeah. So when you say non-market solutions, when you think about presume you've been thinking about what it would actually take to make San Francisco a livable city for the working class. What are the sort of main points of change that you think it needs?
Well, I think the city and government has to be in the business of actually creating housing for people and not for profit, right? And so, we have a long history now, over half a century, of active disinvestment at the federal, state, and local level in affordable housing, in public housing. There's a renewed movement, I think, to look at municipal housing and other forms of government-owned housing. But at the end of the day, there's lots of different types of social housing. There's municipal housing, there's community land trusts, there's limited equity co-ops, there's below market rental units in new construction. There's lots of ways to get there, but all of them share one trait, and that they are off the speculative market, right? They are not created, owned, operated, sold for profit. Mm-hmm. And that's the only kind of housing in an expensive city like San Francisco or a place like New York or Los Angeles. I mean, that's the only kind of housing that's actually going to house low-income and working-class folks. And it may not be like that everywhere in the country, right? I mean, you may be able to create a market-rate unit in a small city that's not San Francisco, and maybe a teacher could afford that market-rate unit, right? It's not one size fits all. But I can just tell you through the lens of the market I know best and where I serve the residents of my district, that it is a pipe dream to think that you're ever going to build market rate housing in San Francisco that a school teacher, a janitor, any working class folks are going to be able to afford.
Is that because it would just take such a colossal amount of new housing, because a lot of what would be built is just going to be bought up and held as investment property. You know, funnily enough, I live in the French Quarter of New Orleans, which is another kind of similar to San Francisco in that it's a, you know, sort of quaint historic district. And I look out my window at night and see no lights in the other windows because so many of the properties are just they're so valuable that they are just held by people as assets. And you realize that if you built 10% more of them, it would just be 10% more that were being held as assets without ever actually being lived in by the people of New Orleans.
I think that's certainly a factor here. I mean, we have a huge issue. We actually commissioned a report, and we're expecting to announce it fairly soon from the budget legislative analyst looking at vacancies in San Francisco. And, you know, there are a ton of vacancies, and a lot of the new construction, these luxury condos that sit particularly south of Market neighborhood in San Francisco, they just sit empty. And it's exactly as you're describing. I mean, you can see at night what's lit up and what isn't, and these buildings, you know, are half empty. These are investments, you know. Well, I've long been a champion of doing a vacancy tax like Vancouver did, which of course, right. You know, again, the same critics and industry folks will oppose that, even as they claim to be in favor of you know, housing and homes and so forth. But, you know, we have to do that, right? Like, because these are just, you know, for a lot of these investors, they're just buying up multiple properties. They sit on them for a while and they resell them. And it's a good investment. And that's, you know, so that's what a lot of the new construction ends up being. So, you know, I think it's two things to your question of like, why doesn't it work to just build more market rate housing, right? Like, why does that not actually result in greater housing equity in a city like San Francisco? And it's two things. It's that that a lot of these sit vacant and are investments and aren't intended for people to live in anyway. And it's that in many cases, it is the more vulnerable low-income communities that are being targeted for that kind of development. And what's being developed is not just more units in a vacuum, it's actually units that gentrify a neighborhood, drive up the prices in those neighborhoods, and drive people out of those communities. And that's why you see all community groups and all folks you know, who are organizing with people of color and vulnerable communities in San Francisco, all in unison, opposing again and again the strategy of just building more and more luxury housing and expecting mm-hmm. that to trickle down. I don't know any vulnerable groups in the city that subscribe to that approach.
Because if you have an apartment building that's 50 units occupied by working class tenants and it's demolished and they build something that has 100 units, but it's 100 people from Palo Alto who come and move in, you can still have, you know, your aggregate, your number of total units has increased. You say we've got more housing, but you haven't done anything. You've actually managed to displace more working class people from the city in the process.
That's right. And then we see that also, we have these evictions here called Ellis Act evictions. There's a state law called the Ellis Act that lets any property owner go out of the rental business. That's the idea. So what happens is they evict everyone in the entire building and say they're going out of the rental business. And then they found a loophole where since they're going out of the rental business, they can't turn around and rent it. So, but what they can do is sell off the interests in these high-end co-ops and condos, basically. Mm. So you have entire buildings in San Francisco that are emptied out of tenants, many of whom are low-income, long-term rent-controlled tenants, to be replaced directly by high-income folks who can come in for $1 million, $2 million buy a condo or tenancy in common. And so that displacement has been happening across the city. I mean, our history in San Francisco is completely shameful, from the redevelopment era in which huge numbers of African-American tenants were driven out of the city, homes demolished, all the way through to waves of evictions during the different booms, dot-com, one boom in the 90s, you know, all the way through to the present. And the constant there is we've always allowed greed and real estate speculation to dominate the policies of the city.
I read a study a while back of rent control in San Francisco, and you're probably more familiar with the literature than I am, but I seem to recall that one of the findings is, you know, the free market types always say, well, the problem with rent control is that it's going to restrict supply, but that the finding in San Francisco was that rent control, first off, it worked, and the only reason that it restricted supply was because of those condo conversions. So the only reason that it would be that rent control caused fewer units to be available to people was because you happened to, where you were doing it, have a loophole that incentivized the owners of buildings to take units off the market. But if you didn't have that loophole, then rent control wouldn't have that negative effect.
Right, right. It's always the loopholes around rent control that are used to attack rent control. I mean, one of the things that where there's just such a disconnect between working class folks and the sort of the pundits, for lack of a better word, is on rent control, right? Like, you go to all these economics departments and you can find lots of professors who are going to tell you how rent control is bad, it distorts the market. You know, a few of them will give you some support, but generally, you know, lots of critics in the academic world of rent control. You go and talk to people who are living in rent control apartments or who live in San Francisco, where there would be virtually no working class left in San Francisco were it not for rent control. You know, the whole reputation as a progressive city, you know, this would just be even a 98% playground for the rich were it not for rent control. And you know, what I did before I was in office, I ran a statewide tenant rights organization, Tenants Together. We formed at the time when there was a ballot measure that was to abolish rent control in California. And we crushed it at the polls. I mean, the voters of California, not just in the big cities, voted by a 22-point margin to not abolish rent control. Like, people love rent control because they get that it's the only thing standing between them and a greedy landlord and them and displacement from their homes. And what's interesting, you know, last thing on that, Nathan, is that that even the studies from the econ professors who attack rent control always have to acknowledge in all those studies how effective rent control is in stabilizing housing for seniors, for disabled folks, for the most vulnerable folks, even as they attack it on theoretical grounds, on its distortion of the market and so forth, they still acknowledge that it works to do what it's supposed to do, which is to stabilize people in their homes.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a great piece of testimony by the economist J.W. Mason, who talks about how rent control is kind of like the minimum wage, in that the previous neoclassical consensus that it was definitely bad has been sort of shaken in recent years in economics. But this other point that you know, a study of supply and demand really really leaves out the fact that what we're talking about when we talk about non-rent controlled housing is the ability of a landlord to tell someone who has been in a building for 30 years, 40 years even, someone whose whole life has been invested in this place but who hasn't actually developed an ownership right, because we don't give people ownership rights purely by having, you know, paid all of their income for decades to live in a place, can tell that person, you know, that all of a sudden they have to leave everything they know and go find something else, which, I mean, when you think about the unquantifiable psychological effect of that on an elderly or disabled person to try and force them through. I mean, it's just such a, you know, to not have rent control is just such an act of wanton cruelty. And I think that you know, no study can even capture that.
Yeah, and it's really true, and people get that, and even as there's been this coordinated attack on rent control over the years, when you actually frame it in terms of its impact, as you just did, people overwhelmingly support it. So when I was running our statewide tenant rights organization, Tenants Together, we would go into communities, fairly conservative communities in the state, work with forming new tenant unions, helping folks to go to their city councils and adopt rent control. And it was so interesting. We would meet with these conservative council members in like the Central Valley of California, you know, Republican strongholds. We'd meet with the legislators there. We'd ask them, you know, their opinion on rent control. Totally oppose it. Absolutely. Like, it's terrible. You know, it's bad for the economy, whatever. Then you ask them the questions you just asked. Do you believe that a tenant who's lived in their home for a decade, that a landlord should be allowed to double their rent? And they'd say, no, of course not. Like, people actually think it's illegal to do these things, to evict someone for no reason, to double their rent, like those things. So they actually agree with the entire policy, even the most conservative folks.
Right.
And even the folks who claim to be against rent control. And I will say, I've been doing this for a while, like over 20 years. When I started, there was more controversy around rent control. Like, in California, people, I mean, they've even, it seems like, given up trying to attack and eliminate rent control. I mean, people look at cities like San Francisco, and as I said before, without rent control, there'd be virtually no working class living in San Francisco. Everyone would be commuting from hours away. So I think the ship's kind of sailed on that. Their attacks on rent control are more subtle because, you know, you put that on the ballot in San Francisco and rent control is going to win every time.
I need to ask you about the YIMBY movement, which you mentioned earlier. And first, could you start for unfamiliar listeners and tell them what the YIMBY movement, again, I'm going to use the word movement in quotes, what YIMBYs are?
Yes, I will definitely put it in quotes. I certainly have seen my share of movements and been part of them. I think there's certainly a movement on Twitter that the YIMBYs inspire. I haven't seen much example of it out in the real world. But, you know, they have, it's essentially the developers and real estate speculators, their new face as of, you know, within the last 7-8 years has been this so-called Yes in My Backyard effort known as YIMBY. And then they have cleverly defined anyone who does not accept every proposed housing development with no changes at the moment it is announced is now a NIMBY. And so, you know, I've always thought of NIMBYs as people who actually like oppose affordable housing, classist folks, often racist folks who don't want homeless people or low-income folks or people of color living in their neighborhoods. That's was always my understanding of a NIMBY. The so-called YIMBY folks have redefined NIMBY to be anyone that doesn't just jump when the real estate industry says jump. And they've become a very toxic force and, you know, certainly have been attacking me for years, attacking pretty much anyone else who demands actual things that help a community as part of development, either investments in transit, investments in affordable housing, and they have, I think, evolved over the years into now what is just a complete disinformation campaign, and that's what you see in their research.
Yeah, well, I think one thing worth noting is that it's quite insidious in the way that it presents itself. I wrote an article trying to expose some of this called "The Only Thing Worse Than a NIMBY Is a YIMBY," and in response to that, because I had denounced both NIMBYs and YIMBYs, one of their supporters said, "Well, there's a whole other category called the left NIMBY." And I am an exemplar of what's called the left NIMBY, and implied that there's something racist about it. There's this strange use of rhetoric, which is supposedly pro-affordable housing, constantly emphasizing its progressive bona fides. I mean, you've said that it's basically an arm of the developers' lobby, which may be true, but it certainly takes great pains to try and present itself as something that is not in the pocket of developers. And certainly, if you accuse this so-called movement of being, hardcore Friedmanite, free market people, they will vigorously protest that characterization. And I think it's a little clever in the way it presents itself.
It is, and look, they will dress it up in the language of equity. The truth really comes out when you look at the actual positions. I mean, people can tweet all they want about their positions. When you look at like any ballot measures, any candidates, any things where it's you have to take a position, they will always 100% of the time side with the money in the real estate industry. And they will ruthlessly attack through disinformation campaigns anyone who doesn't further the interests of big real estate capital. I mean, to the point where, like, when I ran for election, these folks were spreading flyers all around my district saying that I was a serial evictor who had evicted, hundreds of low-income tenants. I've never evicted anyone in my life. I've been an eviction defense lawyer for 20 years. I mean, it's like that. That's the level of discourse. I mean, and it's really sad because I think that there are affordable housing advocates who for years have been advocating for some of the positions that YIMBY folks take. For example, going into exclusionary rich communities or suburban communities and arguing that there should be apartment buildings instead of single family homes in new construction, right? Like, that's a longstanding position that groups like the Western Center on Law and Poverty, folks like myself, have been championing that for a long time and believe in that. And at their best, and it's a shame they don't just stick with this, right? Like, YIMBYs could be partners in that fight. Instead, what they've done is they've weaponized that legitimate issue to turn, those same arguments to attack communities of color and working class communities in dense, expensive cities. And to do so at all costs, and to try to use that same language of equity when all they're doing is trying to maximize real estate profits. And it's, it's sad sometimes to see folks who are in it for good reasons, right? They actually think they're taking on exclusionary single family zoning or something like that. Most of those folks, though, if they're thoughtful, I have found they flee the YIMBY movement once they realize what it's really about.
The sort of precipitating factor behind my wanting to talk to you was that there has been, just very recently in the last week, a new front in the campaign against, you in particular, by the SF YIMBY group, who has put out this report. I gotta put the word report in quotes. They put out a website called Dean Preston's Housing Graveyard, which even features the tombstones of houses that you have personally killed, and was covered by a sympathetic report from the San Francisco Chronicle, and essentially. The argument here, and I see people, and which, as you say, they've got a heavy presence on Twitter, so there's a lot of people picked it up on Twitter. The argument here is that that you have killed a lot of affordable housing. I see the quote saying, Dean Preston has denied housing to 12 people a day since he took office. He must resign so that a responsible public servant can take his place. Dean Preston is the worst politician in San Francisco. He is single-mindedly focused on making sure the city builds no new housing of any kind. Can you tell me, if you could tell me, trying to be charitable to their argument, what their argument against you is that you are denying housing to people.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm in a charitable mood with these folks okay. right now, but I'll try. Just because this hit piece is so out there on the and so just wrong on the facts. Like, I think there are things we could actually debate around, you know, the role of market rate housing in San Francisco. When's it good? When's it not? This thing is just wild. I mean, I published my response called, you know, Alice in Yimby Land, and it's because, you know, this stuff is just made up, and like really, you can go item by item, and it's a complete disinformation campaign. Now, I will say that, like, I think to be charitable and to set aside the fact that most of it is just like complete garbage and made up, there is this concept that I think drives the YIMBYs and Heather Knight, who's a YIMBY reporter who for the Chronicle, who amplified their work of fiction as if it was fact. And I think the idea is that anything you do to require anything of a developer is itself a sin and means that you oppose everything the developer's doing. So I'll give you an example. Like one of their things in their housing report or whatever you want to call it, I put that in quotes, is that I like opposed a project that was being built on Geary Boulevard just outside my district. So what I did was a vote. I was the lone dissenting vote when the developer who had already gotten permission to build years ago came back to the Board of Supervisors and said, we actually don't want to build the affordable units that we promised to build and that your whole rezoning was based on. We don't want to build those in the project. So no change, you know, my vote there, like, didn't stop a single unit of housing. Same number before, with or without my vote, if I had won, makes no difference, right? But the fact that I'm saying to a developer, you can't just do what you want here, and in fact, you have to do what you promised, which is build affordable units on site, it shows up in their silly report as, like, however many units that building was, like, I opposed all those units, right? Like, that's the level of kind of what, and I hate to say it because I don't want to insult, you know, elementary school kids, but this is like elementary school level report at best. And it also, you know, you can go item by item, but it also ignores, and, you know, if we have time, we can talk about, like, the tremendous body of work of what my office has been doing to tax the rich and generate hundreds of millions of dollars for social housing in San Francisco. Like, none of that shows up in this absurd, absurd report. So, I think I'm being charitable when I just call it absurd.
Yeah. I do want to stop calling it a report, because this is one of the tactics that right-wing fake think tanks use, is they put out things that they call reports so that then they can say, oh, a report or a study was done and it says this or that. Essentially, they build a website, and the website claims that a lot of people who would have houses in San Francisco do not have houses because of your actions personally. I think one of the key points underlying what you're saying is that people need to understand, right? And so correct me if this is an incorrect characterization, is that in the process of some building being proposed for development, you have these levers given what your position on the Board of Supervisors, and what you are able to do is use the threat of blocking to try and exact concessions from developers, and that is actually quite important, because if we take, you know, even on pure free market theory, a developer's interest is in putting no affordable units in any building ever. Why would they? They would never want to do that unless they had to. So I take it part of what you are doing that is being then spun against you as blocking housing is trying to find ways to use the power that you possess to exact concessions that are actually going to help people from developers.
That's exactly right. And that's not only what I'm doing since I've been in office, but it's what I've done for years. So I was you know, among the folks leading the effort to pass a ballot measure that required a minimum percentage of affordable units when developers build private housing. That whole concept is opposed by YIMBYs. I mean, their founder in San Francisco is on record saying that she opposes any inclusionary housing requirement. In other words, developers, when they build luxury housing, should not have to pay a single cent or build a single unit that is not at that market luxury rate. So that's her position, and I'm on the opposite extreme, right? My view is, I'm happy to have the project built, and I want to make sure we don't leave anything on the table. I want to get as much affordable as I can. If you look at my consistent record is always pushing for that highest level of affordability. And the developers know that. I mean, the irony here is that the YIMBYs are even worse than the developers. Like I work with the developers and deal with them all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, they're trying to get projects through, and they know when they come to my office. I mean, we approved a big one down at 98 Franklin. Again, totally omitted from the report, which says I approved 0 units of housing when I approved this major residential, you know, tower in my district. But the developers knew if they wanted my support, they ended up promising, and they're going to deliver 25% of the units, you know, are at affordable levels for working class folks in the city and for low income folks, as well as additional millions of dollars additional in funds for affordable housing, right? So, you know, is that perfect? No, I mean, you know, I see my role as advocating on the behalf of the community, as mm-hmm. getting as much as possible from developers in the private market. Even then, even when I can do it, it's not the most satisfying stuff. I'd rather be building 100% affordable housing. I'd rather be doing, you know, social housing, all the things that we went to the ballot and actually won. But what we still have, the private market stuff is part of the ecosystem here. We got to deal with it, and we got to make sure we're getting as much as possible from the developers as we can.
You know, this website implies at various points that you represent a rich district and you're trying to do the bidding of landlords in your district who are having, you know, essentially rich NIMBYs who don't want any housing built. And I guess one of the important points, I suppose, for your constituents to sort of understand when they see what you're doing in office would be that if you come out against or conditionally against some kind of project, what you're really trying to do is to set terms and to set conditions that developers are going to have to meet if they want to move forward, and that in the sort of chess match between you and developers, what developers are going to then come back and do, or what this YIMBY AstroTurf movement is going to come back and do, is going to say, aha, your board of supervisors is in the pocket of landlords. They don't want to build any housing. But what's actually going on is a fight over the conditions under which something will move forward.
I think that's accurate. I would just say that it is always amusing when someone says I'm in the pockets of landlords or wealthy real estate industry, because like those folks have fought, I mean, put millions of dollars into fighting to keep me out of office. Like I do think and take comfort in looking at the level of disinformation and attacks is to me very much a sign of how we have been able to move the needle in terms of taxing the very wealthy and in terms of trying to get a focus on affordable housing and social housing. The landlords, you know, I have sparred with landlords and the California Association of Realtors. These folks did hit piece after hit piece. They backed my opponent in every election. They've backed, the opposition to every ballot measure that I've worked on. The reality is that they agree 100% with these YIMBYs. I mean, there's no daylight between the developers, landlords, billionaires, and YIMBYs in San Francisco. When you look at my district and people make comments about my district, my district is one of the most dense districts in the city and nationally. It's a very dense district. It's a very diverse district with more well-off areas as well as some of the most low-income areas of the city. And folks knew what they were getting with me. You know, they knew they were getting a democratic socialist who was not going to be out there fighting to maximize luxury housing. And so I am doing what I said I'd do. And that, frankly, pisses off political opponents and certainly it has been, you know, fueling the attacks that, as I say, have been ratcheted up because we keep winning. Because the people of San Francisco are down with, I mean, we doubled the transfer tax. We charge 6%, one of the highest in the nation, when someone sells a $10 million property. These real estate investors are paying huge amounts of money because I wrote a ballot measure and we won it despite them outspending us 20-1. And we are raising $150 to $200 million a year for affordable social housing, first social housing money generated in San Francisco in generations, right? It's like, that's what they, and the YIMBYs opposed all that stuff or stayed silent or opposed every step of the way. And that's what they're trying to stop. It's less about me than that movement that is demanding more from the rich and demanding affordable housing.
Can I give you a chance to respond on these pieces of legislation they say that you opposed that would have helped make housing affordable? They say they cite SB 35, the Streamlined Affordable Housing Act, which they say would made it harder for San Francisco to say no to proposed housing that's at least 50% affordable and led San Francisco to build thousands of affordable homes of the kind Preston says he supports. They say opposing Home SF, the Affordable Housing Density Program, allowing for additional housing to be built if it contains affordable homes. And they cite SB 50, which allows new dense housing near transit. I assume the story is far more complicated. I don't understand California very well, so perhaps you could tell me what is being massaged here.
Yeah, the story, the policies in those bills are complex. The story is very, very simple. I mean, in these, you know, I worked at Tenants Together. We worked on state legislation. I stood with a coalition of every tenant group in the state, local grassroots, you know, POC-led groups, transit equity groups and others demanding amendments to these state laws. Some of which were incorporated and some of which were not. We told Senator Wiener, who was the champion of these, that we love this streamlining, but can we apply it to just affordable housing? Like, why are we doing this giveaway to the market rate housing? We urged higher requirements of affordable housing, stronger protections against displacement and demolitions, right? And so pieces of that advocacy ended up in the bill. And what they're saying, again, is the YIMBY test is, did I accept the developer-written bill the moment it was introduced? Anything short of that is blocking the housing, right? So this is just totally make-believe, right? Like it is absolutely absurd that standing shoulder to shoulder with vulnerable communities who are trying to prevent gentrification and displacement and demolition of their homes and fight for more affordable housing, that standing with those folks and seeking to improve state legislation is somehow an act of anti-housing or whatever they want to call it. So it's, you know, each bill you can pick apart and go through, but that's the bottom line. Yeah. All these things are things I sought amendments and improvements to.
Well, so just quickly, what's the thing with the hospital? They say, did you know? Preston identifies as a socialist, but exposed the expansion of a public hospital during a pandemic.
Same story, you know. Yeah. So UCSF is doing a major hospital expansion. I've certainly never opposed the expansion. When I came into office, I actually urged the city to do an MOU between the hospital, which is like a state agency actually, and the city to guarantee affordable housing levels. A deal was worked out. It wasn't good enough. I worked with the hospital workers who couldn't afford any of the housing that was going to be built with this hospital to argue that there should be more deeply affordable housing as part of this plan. And what we did, this is their whole act. This is the absurdity here. This is a multi-year project. they were, the UC was going to the state regents, which actually controls UCSF. We said that we did a resolution at the board that I authored saying it should wait till their next meeting because we needed stronger affordable housing commitment, transit investments in public transit to support this project, and a stronger, the agreement had no enforceability. Those were the three issues I raised. Mm. As a result of my advocacy, within a week, UCSF actually agreed to improve the affordability and provide more housing for the workers of the hospital. And we also confirmed on the record with UCSF that the short delay in presenting this to the regents would have zero impact on the construction timeline for the hospital or the housing. Zero impact. So literally that's their example that I blocked all those housing units by seeking to have the regents wait to their next meeting so that we could nail down the enforceability, transit investments, and affordable housing, right? It's the same story. It really is the same story.
Well, I appreciate you diving into the details because I think that it's, I want our, because it'll be transcribed, I want our readers and our listeners to understand, because in every city there are going to be these kinds of disinformation campaigns. And it's really important because the arguments they make, if you don't know the actual facts, can be superficially persuasive. I mean, you see all of this and they're very well put together. I mean, we can say that they're transparently absurd, but they're not, in fact, transparently absurd if you don't know the truth and if the truth isn't available. I mean, this has appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle now. It is now, I was mentioning to you before the recording, that this is now all over your Wikipedia entry because they seem to have very diligent Wikipedia editors, the EMBs. And I do think it's really important to learn how to dissect this stuff. I wonder, just finally, if there are any sort of lessons from your long fight as a tenants' rights advocate that things that you've learned, advice you'd have for people fighting this same fight in other cities around the country that have some of the same problems.
I think just, you know, to really organize with people directly and to not, not assume that what occurs on social media is actually the dominant views of communities. And there's a ton of people who really aren't following the back and forth on Twitter of the libertarian, YIMBY Twitter stuff. And, what we've seen in San Francisco is that at the polls, when it comes to actual voters and people in our city, people get it. People don't buy that, luxury multi-million dollar investment housing is like the answer to our problems. And that's why, in San Francisco, the YIMBYs have lost every candidate that they've run and back, like everyone loses, their ballot measures get crushed at the polls. And really the only power that they have politically is when they get appointed to things by one of the only politicians that sides with them nowadays, which is the mayor of San Francisco, which is its own story. But, so they'll get an occasional appointment there. But what I would say is just like for folks is that, meeting folks, dealing with their real world issues, going to meetings in person or Zoom or, engaging on these issues. People aren't fooled so easily. And so some of these, cute sleight of hand tricks that do work in some, communities nationally. And I mean, hell, Fox News and, Tucker Carlson sort of make a living off this stuff, right? But at least in progressive cities, I don't think people are fooled that easily. And I would just urge folks, anyone I was given advice to, is just keep doing the work and meeting folks in the real world, not necessarily on the housing Twitter.
Yeah, if you haven't been the subject of a Fox News profile yet, I would give it 5 minutes. I'm sure they're...
I'm sure it's coming, the sad part really is not, there's always going to be folks who are organizing to preserve status quo and preserve profits. I think what was sad about this whole this last week was seeing the Chronicle not just side, you know, sort of like publish this report, but just from a journalistic integrity point of view, to not do like an ounce of actual fact checking, investigation, analysis, and simply like publish this thing as if it's something. And again, while ignoring a report that came out days later from housing advocates, the labor community, and UC Berkeley researchers, which just tells the exact opposite story and talks about the actual housing needs. It's sad to see a major paper and that we're at a state in our discourse on these things where a major paper would just regurgitate this stuff.
Yeah, that was what, one of the things that really alarmed me, where I thought, you know, just and I saw some, you know, some people that I moderately respect parroting these claims as if they were you know, this the result of a real economic study, and then I open the webpage and it's just the cheapest kind of political propaganda. Anyway, I don't want to take more of your time. You've got important work to do out there in San Francisco. I wish you all the best. Dean Preston of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The Current Affairs Podcast is a product of Current Affairs Magazine. If you are not subscribed to Current Affairs Magazine, visit currentaffairs.org/subscribe today and get our glorious print edition. The Current Affairs Podcast is released regularly every week on patreon.com/currentaffairs. Thanks for listening.